Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Welcome to the Faculty Book Review. In this podcast, J. Skelly Wright Professor of Law, Heather Gerken, discusses her new book, The Democracy Index, in which she proposes a ranking system that would rate the performance of state and local election systems. Professor Gerken is interviewed by Caitlin Thomas, Assistant Director of Public Affairs at the Yale Law School.
Welcome, Professor Gerken.
Thank you for having me.
You first wrote about your idea for a democracy index in Legal Times a couple of years ago. How did you first come up with the idea for the index?
So I was at this conference where we were talking with a commissioner of the Election Assistance Commission, who is basically in charge of helping Americans deal with the administrative structures that govern them. And as we were talking about it, I realized, it's funny when you're talking to an administrator and you're surrounded by academics, the U.S. News and World Reports just inevitably comes up in your head. And it's had such an effect on the way universities conduct their business, on what choices students make. And I realized that there's nothing like that in the voting context, and that it would be incredibly useful for voters to have the same kind of shorthand that is available in lots of other areas of our lives to think about the problem of election administration.
And how would a democracy index work? Who would gather the data, and how would it be gathered?
Well, so the basic idea is to construct something like a U.S. News and World Report ranking for how well election systems perform at the state and local level. So that you need two things. One is you need good data, and two is you need someone to assemble it. So on the good data front, there's two ways of going about it. The first would be, for example, for Congress to require states to gather and disclose some very basic set of information, which some of them collect and some of them don't, and some of them disclose and some of them don't. And that would be, I think, the most useful thing that Congress could do. Then there's a second question, which would be, if Congress weren't to mandate that, you could still imagine gathering a lot of this information using private sources. So, for example, you could have voter surveys that would give you a lot of information about how well the voting system is working. You could imagine having election administrators just doing surveys of their own voters on election day. You could use random sampling. I like the idea of having Nielsen voters. So Nielsen voter would be just the same thing as a Nielsen viewer who records his television habits. So you just basically tell someone, how long did it take me to register? When I got to the polling place, was I properly registered? How long did it take me to find the polling place? How long did it take me to vote? So there's a basic set of information you could gather privately as well. Once you have the information, then the next step is to pull it together. And here I think my own preference would be for a highly respected nonprofit to do it, or a university to do it. So somebody who's a little bit outside the political fray. Imagine, for example, the Pew Foundation, which routinely puts together indices like this. The reason why it's nice to have a nonprofit do it is that at some level, while the basic metrics you'd be looking at for the democracy index are not politically freighted, that is, they're the kinds of things that everyone can agree on. Lines shouldn't be very long. The registration system should work. Everything in political administration has some partisan effect. And so rather than have it in the government, where the temptation for politicians to twiddle with it and slant it in one direction or another would be pretty intense, I'd rather give it to a nonprofit or a university that's slightly shielded from those political pressures and can put together a more sensible index.
When you first proposed this in 2007, there's some reaction to it. Can you tell me what that reaction was?
So it was an amazing surprise. I wrote a 700-word editorial, sent it off to the Legal Times, which is has a pretty good wonky audience in Washington, D.C. And then, much to my surprise, I got calls from the Senate staffs of both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Both of them eventually put the idea into a bill, so two separate bills. And I actually, at that moment, this falls under the category of be careful what you wish for. So I thought, well, this is great. Two of the most powerful senators in the country are backing my bill. I forgot that they actually might be running against one another for president. And so just shortly thereafter, the two candidates began to run against each other, and legislation was they got less attention for their legislation than they might have because they were busy in the campaign. Happily, even in the interim, lots of stuff has happened. So Congress set aside $10 million to fund model data collection in the states, because if you're going to have data collection, you need to know how much it costs and what's the best way of doing it. And then several nonprofits, including the Joyce Foundation and the Pew Foundation and AEI Brookings, have started sponsoring conferences. So there was a conference about how you would construct a democracy index. And then the Pew Foundation has had a long-standing commitment to improving data collection. And so they had another conference about just what kind of data would you want to collect for evaluating our democracy. So there's been lots of movement since. And I think there's some hope that, this will actually see the light of day.
Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004 are some of the more infamous examples of what can go wrong with elections. Are these isolated incidents, or are they just the tip of the iceberg? And have there been other similar problems that have gone unnoticed by the public?
So the funny thing about Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004 is that almost everyone thinks that they were just special moments. It just badly run states, problems that existed there and nowhere else. The fact of the matter is that the problems we saw in both of those states happen all the time in elections across the country. The only key difference is this. In those elections, it was close. And in most elections, it isn't close. So what happens is this sort of unfortunate effect. Reporters are only going to report on the problems that affect the outcome. Most reporters close their notebooks the day after the election once we know who the winner is. So just think about it. For example, Minnesota is probably, as far as we know, a pretty well-run state. And yet everyone's looking at all the problems that occurred during the election precisely because the vote totals were so close to one another. MIT just released a report that said the 2008 election, voters encountered about as many problems as they did in 2000. And yet what happened in 2008? Everyone reported that the election ran smoothly. The election didn't run smoothly. It's just the election wasn't close. So this, I think, is the real problem the index is trying to address. What we're doing now is trying to measure annual rainfall based on how often lightning strikes. That is, we only know when there's a problem if the election just happens to be close, if there's a turnout tsunami that floods one state or another. But the truth is, we need to have a sort of a gauge of how well our election system is working even when the elections aren't close. Because otherwise, we're really going to have no idea whether Ohio and Florida are outliers or whether actually they just happen to be in the way of a turnout tsunami that too few states are equipped to handle.
You spent Election Day 2008 in the Obama campaign's boiler room. What was that like? What kind of problems are being reported at the polls?
Well, this was the most amazing experience if you care about election administration, because I got to see the invisible election. So I was just telling you, reporters are only going to tell you about what happens when the election is close. So I got to see what was really going on the ground, because as you sort of imagine this giant room with phone booths to each of the boiler rooms in all the swing states and a computer database. And across that computer database, we're running the reports of all the thousands of volunteers and lawyers and campaign staffers reporting on election problems over the course of the day. And what was happening in the boiler room is that we were monitoring those problems and trying to figure out when we needed to step in and when we didn't need to step in. So what I saw of the invisible election was nothing like what was reported on Election Day. There were some places where everything was quite smooth and easy, and there were places where the jurisdictions just fell apart as wave after wave of voters crashed down upon them. So there were jurisdictions where people had to wait 3 or 4 hours in line, and this affected thousands of people. There were jurisdictions that had been moved at the last minute. There were jurisdictions where poll workers hadn't the faintest idea what the basic rules were for giving out provisional ballots dealing with people who weren't properly registered. There were jurisdictions, oddly enough, that ran out of ink for their pens because they just had many more voters than they had thought they would get, and so they ran out of ink. There were jurisdictions that ran out of ballots. And what was shocking to me about how many problems there were was this. This was an election where everybody knew that the turnout was going to be higher than almost any election we'd seen. This was an election when one campaign, recognizing that its ability to elect its candidate was going to depend on registering a lot of new voters and getting them to the polls. And so it had done a lot of work with election administrators to make things go smoothly. And this was a campaign where a third of American voters voted before Election Day. So it's not like everyone showed up on Election Day. A lot of the pressures on the system were eased. And yet we still had these problems, the same problems we saw in 2004 and 2000. And to me, that's a sign that we need to rethink the way we go about election reform.
Why would this kind of index make a difference? And given the economic downturn, should this still be a priority of the Obama administration, and why?
So a couple of reasons. It would make a difference in lots of different ways. So one of the problems I've talked about is the problem of the invisible election. So we work in a decentralized system, and the idea of a decentralized system is that states and localities will compete to fund the things that citizens care about. And in a world where a problem is completely invisible, which is true of our election system, it's also true of maintaining roads and bridges. You know, in some ways, deferred maintenance is really the problem in our election system, just as it is about our physical infrastructure. You don't fund things that voters can't see. And so one of the things that's crucial is to at least give voters the knowledge they need to recognize that this is a problem, no matter how they're ultimately going to prioritize it. Another thing is, actually, I think there are a lot of things that don't cost any money at all. But legislators, policymakers, even election bureaucrats have no way of knowing what's working or what's not, because you can't figure out what the driver performance is if you don't even know who's performing well. So there's a way in which the index would give everyone access to the most important piece of information, which is who's doing well. And then you could sort of think about, well, what is it that is causing them to do well? In many of these instances, it may be a policy that is just as cheap and effective as the one that exists now that will fix the problem. So in lots of ways, this is a really cheap way of getting to a better reform. That being said, it's still going to cost some money. It turns out these days, costing some money turns out to be a feature rather than a bug. But I think I'll just say this. I don't mean to rank this up with, you know, nuclear deterrence and world peace. It's not that big a priority. On the other hand, when we think about all the other things that we care about, the vote is something we care about quite a lot. And, you know, just to give you an example, everywhere else in the public and private sector, for lots and lots of issues, from the arcane to the deeply important, we measure what matters. Walmart has such an excellent measuring system that it knows that when a hurricane is coming, people not only buy generators and flashlights, but strawberry Pop-Tarts. It seems to me odd that we have more information about the sale of strawberry Pop-Tarts than we do about the way we treat our most precious non-commodity, which is the right to vote. So at the very least, it seems to me we ought to have the information to know what kind of decisions are there to be made and what aren't, whether we could invest more money and get something done, or whether in fact muddling through is the best thing that we can do. That's a very small amount of money to get us to the point of making a rational decision about this. And so to me, that is at the very least worth the investment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.